We have developed the ability to re-engineer plants so they can kill insects and now grow millions of acres of insect-killing corn plants. If you are a farmer, you simply must love this technology. Now you can grow food without having to buy pesticides because the pesticides are in the food. But if you're a consumer, you simply must pause to ask, who says genetically modified foods are safe to eat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 794th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Brisbane who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Good to see you.
Folks, what do you mean, see me? You're on the radio. You can't see me.
Well, we can see each other.
Okay, fair enough. Folks, if you think about it from the perspective of a farmer, you just have to love the promise of our ability to re-engineer life. Take corn, for example. It used to be that a farmer would have to protect his crop of corn plants from ravenous insects by spraying expensive chemical pesticides. Now we can re-engineer corn plants so that every cell in every corn plant contains the active genes of Bacillus thuringiensis, a soil-dwelling bacterium that produces chemicals toxic to insects. When insects take a bite out of any part of that BT corn, from root to tassel, the insect stomach explodes and it dies. End of the insects. No wonder, then, that we now have millions of acres of insect-killing BT corn growing in the heartland of our nation. But if you think about it, the insect-killing food from the perspective of a consumer, you simply must ask, who says genetically modified foods are safe for people to eat? Here to help us find an answer, we have Mr. Consumer himself, and that would be Dr. Michael Hansen, Senior Staff Scientist for the Consumers Union. Dr. Hansen, welcome to the Food Chain.
Nice to be on your program, Michael.
Yeah, so first of all, you're the Senior Staff Scientist. What does a Senior Staff Scientist do?
I actually work on food safety and technology issues. So in the genetic engineering area, I've been the one that has developed policy positions and technical positions on this issue for actually over 20 years. And I not only do it here at Consumers Union, but there's a global network of consumer organizations called Consumers International. There are 220 members in 115 countries, and they've taken a stand on this actually for the past 25 years, and I've helped with that as well. So I work on these technology issues, not just genetic engineering, mad cow disease, cloning, nanotechnology.
So you're there for the consumer. Now, Consumers Union, is it really a union of consumers?
No, it's the policy and advocacy division of Consumer Reports, the magazine. We're the product testing magazine.
Okay, and so then you really are then kind of representative of consumers then, right?
Oh, yes. We have Consumer Reports, which used to be called Consumers Union, has been around now for 76 years. And we have, between our print and online subscribers, we've got a little over 8 million. So, yes, we're the largest consumer organization in the U.S.
Then who pays the way? We always like to ask.
Consumers Union is a nonprofit, or Consumer Reports is, and virtually all our funding comes from people that buy the magazine or that subscribe online.
Okay, essentially then you're representing people who want to know about things like...
Yeah, because our annual subscription is $30, and if you do the math, we have a little over 8 million that subscribe online or to the print version. and that's a significant sum of money. So
then you don't have to take money from outside sources then to...
No, we do have, there is some grants and that, but there is a fairly strict no commercialization policy here.
Good enough. Now, let's turn to genetically modified foods. But this, of course, is a huge issue out in California, especially because of Proposition 37, the right to know. Consumers out here in California are asking for the right to have their foods, their genetically modified foods labeled as such. And, of course, the industry that manufactures them is standing up against that right to know. So it's a big issue right now. But let's take it right down to the gritty nitty and talk about exactly what is genetically modified foods. Maybe you could help us out. Maybe we could just kind of focus on the BT corn, and that will help people.
What I can say is genetically modified, or I also like to call it genetically engineered foods. Those are crops that have been engineered with, you construct what's called a genetic cassette, and then you're inserting it into whatever plant, whether it's corn or soybeans. And this technology allows you to move genetic material between any organisms on Earth. So it overcomes natural species barriers. So the example that you're talking about, the so-called BT corn, is they take a modified version of a soil bacterium, of an endotoxin from a soil bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, and they engineer that into the corn or whatever plant. The reason that they chose that is because, at least when it's used by organic farmers, BT is a natural soil bacteria. It's allowed to be used in organic agriculture because when it's sprayed, it's only sprayed for a small period of time. It harms the insects and then degrades very quickly. But these engineered ones, they are producing massive amounts. There has been a recent study that has come out that has said that the amount of BT that is being produced by the corn, at least in the SmartStack variety, is over 10,000 times the amount that would be in the soil naturally.
Wow. So, I mean, there's 10,000 times more BT in a single corn plant?
No, well, in an acre.
In an acre, okay.
Corn compared to what would be there in the soil naturally.
Now, with respect to BT corn, we now have corn that has BT in every cell of the corn plant, correct?
Yes, that's they don't have the technology yet. Well, they do, but the technology isn't there in terms of what's out on the market to have stuff that is selectively turned on. Although I believe that there is a new corn variety that where they have the issue just turned on in certain
parts of
cells, right?
Wow.
But if, virtually all of them, they're in every single cell, even the pollen, and even
so, an insect flying along can bite any part of any corn plant, any BT corn plant, and
be affected. Well, and would ingest the endotoxin. But what you need to know is there's dozens and dozens and dozens of these delta endotoxins. They're called cry proteins, and that's because of their crystalline structure. The main ones that are in the plants, the most widespread ones, cry 1AB and 1AC, they tend to be specific to caterpillar pests, basically to moths and butterfly larvae. And they tend not to affect other insects because of the physiology of the gut of those. But there are certain kinds of BT, that, for example, the 3BB varieties that are work against corn rootworm, which is a beetle larvae.
Mm-hmm. So essentially what you're saying is that they can craft the BT to go after specific bugs.
Right. And right now, if I would say there's probably at least 10 different cry proteins that may be put into plants. There's actually this new corn variety that came out last year called SmartStax, and it's got 6 different BT proteins in it, and then 2 different genes that code for resistance to resistance to herbicides. And that's actually the a larger field. If we look at the The BT traits globally, they're in like 35% of the engineered crops have that trait. But far more, 85% is actually these herbicide-resistant crops. And these are crops that are engineered to resist herbicides, primarily glyphosate, which is trade name Roundup. So, for example, over 95% of the soybeans in the U.S. that are engineered are Roundup ready, so that means they're designed to have Roundup sprayed on them. If we look at sugar beets, 90% are engineered. If we look at canola, again, canola is about 90%.
Okay, going to hold that thought. We're going to have to take a quick break, folks. This is the Food Chain. We're looking at genetically engineered foods, and we're asking, who says they are safe? SmartStax, a corn plant that will kill insects and resist being killed by herbicides. And hey, we eat this stuff. Is it safe? Somebody says it is. Who is that? Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, consider the SmartStax corn out there, growing out there in the heartland of our nation. 6 different kinds of BT pesticide infused in every cell of that plant, as well as 2 kinds of genes that allow the plant to resist glyphosate herbicide. Man, think of it, if you think of yourself as a farmer, this is great stuff. You can plant your crop out there. Your crop kills 6 kinds of bugs, and then you can dump herbicide on it and kill all the weeds. Duck soup for a producer. But what about consumers? I mean, we look at SmartStax corn and think, well, who says that stuff is safe to eat? And that's the question we have on the table today with Dr. Michael Hansen, who is the senior staff scientist at Consumers Union. Dr. Hansen, what happens to all that stuff in the corn when it's harvested? All of the stacks that are in SmartStax corn.
Well, in the corn that people eat, it is in there, and then in the material that's left on the ground or that's turned over, like the stalks, then that goes into the ecosystem, goes basically into the soil.
So it doesn't go away.
Well, some of the, as it decays, some of that stuff does disappear, but some of the BT does actually stick around in certain kinds of soils. It will grab onto clay particles, and so the levels of BT can actually increase in the soil. And I don't know how wonderful this is for farmers, because farmers often don't have much of a choice of what they buy, because many of the seed companies have been bought up by large transnational pesticide companies.
That's kind of another story that I was trying to avoid, but I just want to go back to the consumers and really focus on the safety here, because having worked with this subject for probably just about as long as you've been studying it, I don't know if it's safe or not, and that's really what I'm trying to figure out today. Who says it's safe?
The problem here in the United States is they decided a little over 20 years ago, then Vice President Dan Quayle introduced this policy as a deregulatory initiative, and it was announced, I believe, on May 29th, 1992, at a biotechnology industry organization gathering. And so what that means is they said, well, genetic engineering or genetic modification is just an extension of conventional breeding, so we will treat them the same under the law, which means no required safety assessments before the products come on the market. Now, they're voluntary safety consultations, but it's the companies that say this stuff is safe.
Okay, so let's back up a step here. So it's what it sounds to me like. Industry and government got together and came up with this doctrine. And I think the doctrine has the name of a substantial equivalence or something like that, that says essentially that since a plant is substantially the same, that really haven't changed it, that you don't have to do any safety assessments. Is that kind of where we're going here?
Well, it actually was before that. The key decision, at least in the U.S., was made around 1985 or 1986, and that was, they called it the coordinated framework. And there was a decision back then that basically said all the agencies with this new science of biotechnology or genetic engineering, that there's nothing new here. We don't need new regulations, so we will use existing regulations. And this was something that was decided upon by the EPA, FDA, USDA, Health and Human Services, the CDC, and others. So genetic engineering does represent a new way of doing things, and you need new laws. So in the food area, after they decided that they weren't going to really regulate this, yes, they did use the concept, because the concept of substantial equivalence first gets floated at these OECD meetings and that the Food and Agriculture Organization mm-hmm. hosted right around 1992. And the U.S. did play a key role in this.
So essentially what that doctrine says is that the corn that we grew before and the corn with six kinds of BT in it and two kinds of glyphosate-resistant genes are substantially equivalent, even though one kind kills insects and the other one doesn't.
Well, what they say is the doctrine of substantially equivalence basically says, well, if we look at a range of nutritional or other parameters, they just say, well, these new varieties are in that same range, and in terms of what you're inserting in there, they would argue that, for example, the BTs and that, well, they've been around there naturally. They've been mm-hmm. in the soil. So legally, what the way the FDA does it is they would allow companies to determine them as what's called grass, generally regarded as safe. And that is actually a key way that they do this. So what they do for substantially equivalence is they just look at a bunch of nutritional parameters and they say, well, these new varieties are roughly the same as the old ones, so we don't need to do any further testing and we don't need to label.
And so essentially then, because this corn has the same new or calorie content as this corn or the same amount of phosphorus in it or whatever.
Right, yeah.
Then,
yes, that's
then they're
it.
Substantially equivalent, and therefore, since this BT exists in the environment, nothing has really changed, so there we are.
Right, and so what that means is the FDA, except for the Flavor Saver tomato, when that product came on the market, Calgene actually asked the agency to treat, because you often have to have what are called marker genes, they asked the agency to treat this antibiotic-resistant marker gene as a food additive. And a food additive requires a safety assessment. And Calgene actually labeled their product. But other than that, all the 85-plus safety consultations that have happened since then, they're all these voluntary ones, and the FDA doesn't make any kind of conclusion about the safety of any of these things.
Wait a minute. Are you saying the federal government makes no assertion as to the safety or the efficacy of genetically modified foods?
That's correct. They absolutely do not. What happens at the end of a safety consultation is the companies come in and they just submit a summary of their safety and nutritional data, right? And the agency if they ask for more information, the companies don't have to turn it over. They can say no. And so at the end of this process, the companies get a letter. I will read you one sentence that was in one of the first letters that went to Monsanto for their first BT corn variety. It was called Mon-A-10. This sentence that I will read to you is in all, except for the Flavor Saver letter, is in all the letters that have gone out. And here's the sentence. And this is, again, the FDA writing to Monsanto on September 25th, 1996. Quote, based on the safety and nutritional assessment you have conducted, it is our understanding that Monsanto has concluded that corn, grain, and forage derived from the new variety are not materially different in composition, safety, or other relevant parameters from corn, grain, and forage currently on the market, and that they do not raise issues that would require pre-market review or approval by the FDA, end quote. That is in all the letters except for the Flavor Saver.
So the federal government is saying, in essence, that Monsanto says it's okay, so it's okay.
Right. No, the agency does not say it's okay. At the end of the letter, they tell the company, you know, that of course, you're responsible for making sure that anything you put on the market is safe. So what is going on with these letters is all the FDA is saying to the companies, we understand you think that they're safe and they don't raise issues that would require us to actually make a safety assessment. And they then remind them that anything they put on the market has to be safe. So if a food like that turns out to cause human health problems, then the company could be liable. Because if the FDA had said, we agree, we think these foods are safe, right, when...
Then the government's liable.
Then the company would get some kind of liability protection.
Well, then now what we have to figure out is how do we know that the companies that are manufacturing these products know that they are safe? Folks,
well,
this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson with Dr. Michael Hansen and you. Are the foods, the genetically modified foods we eat, safe? Who says they are safe? That's the question today. Right back. Stay tuned. Well, folks, who says that the genetically modified foods that we eat are safe? Does the federal government? Well, I don't know. Does it? Does the federal government conduct any safety tests on the genetically modified foods grown in this country, Dr. Michael Hansen?
The answer to that question, as I've said, is no. They do not conduct that, and they don't even make any conclusions about the studies that the companies have submitted. They just get this letter afterwards, and this was not what happened with the Flavor Saver tomato. And what's ironic to me is the person that conducted those studies, those safety studies for the Flavor Saver tomato, her name was Dr. Belinda Martineau. She actually wrote a book 10 years ago called First Fruit, The Creation of Flavor Saver Tomato and the Birth of Biotech Foods, where she criticized the FDA functionally for not requiring any of that. And I just would like to read you a quote from the book. And that, this is Dr. Belinda Martineau speaking. She says, quote, rather than personal opinion, the scientific community should give the public facts, hard facts, the results of studies that indicate these foods are safe to eat and that growing them on a large scale will not cause environmental damage. Scientists and regulators throughout the ag biotech industry agree that more public education about genetic engineering research is necessary, but thus far, few have provided much information beyond how the technology works and the wondrous things that might be done with it. And simply proclaiming that, quote, these foods are safe and there is no evidence, scientific evidence to the contrary, end quote, is not the same as saying, quote, extensive tests have been conducted and here are the results, end quote. In fact, without further elaboration, quote, no scientific evidence to the contrary, end quote, could be construed as, quote, no scientific evidence, period, end quote. It's gotten a little bit better, but again, there has been very little independent study of these crops. There actually has been some independent safety studies, which do raise safety questions.
Well, yeah, let's talk about
studies that suggest there's no problem.
Let's talk about the studies. What, you know, we have land grant universities, we have a tremendous amount of know-how in our universities here in the United States, throughout the world. Are universities looking at the safety of these genetically modified foods? What do they say?
Well, the land-grant universities would be looking at the environmental impacts. And unfortunately, because these are patented crops, before a land-grant university scientist can do any research on them, they have to get approval from the company to do the research that they want. So that means they have to tell the company, I plan to do this research. Will you allow me to do it? And this is such a problem that in 2009, 26 scientists from land-grant universities sent a letter to the Environmental Protection Agency that basically said, we cannot do our jobs because of the problems of they complain that the crop developers are keeping their rights to study biotech crops. What they said is the company control starts with a simple grower's contract. It literally says you cannot give seeds to anyone. So if a scientist wants to look at any of these safety issues, they have to get permission from the company. And so that
if the XYZ company, for example, holds a patent on BT corn, and a land-grant college wants to study the efficacy of this BT corn on the environment, it has to ask permission of XYZ Corporation. And
that's
XYZ
correct.
Corporation can look at the study and think, maybe I don't think I want to give this to you.
That's correct. They can say, for example, one of the concerns was that they want to compare Monsanto's certain BT corn variety with maybe Syngenta's or some other companies, do some side-by-side comparisons. Nope, that's not permitted to do that. So that's why these scientists, they wrote to the Environmental Protection Agency, and they actually had to do it in an anonymous fashion because they were afraid of reprisals from the companies. And now some of these scientists have spoken publicly about this, but when you cannot do independent research, you have to get approval from the companies. It doesn't make for very good research out there.
It kind of takes away the independence of the independent research when you have to.
Exactly. It would be saying, I wonder how much information we would have on the harms of tobacco if the tobacco industry could dictate to the scientist what kind of studies they could do or not do. And let me give you an example of how some of this suppression works. Here's an example from an article that was written a couple of years ago in Nature. In 2001, Pioneer was developing a transgenic or a BT corn variety that contained this. It was a Cry 35 AB1. This was to fend off rootworms. The company asked some university laboratories to test for unintended effects on a ladybird beetle. That's a predatory insect, so it eats other insects. So it's
right. We all love ladybugs.
Yep. The laboratory found that nearly 100% of the lady beetles that had been fed on the crop died after the eighth day in the life cycle. When the researchers presented those results to Pioneer, the company forbade them from publishing the data. Quote, the company came back and said, quote, you are under no circumstances able to publicize this data in any way, end quote, said a scientist associated with the project who asked to remain anonymous. Because the product had not yet been commercialized, the research agreement gave Pioneer the right to prevent publication of those of their results. 2 years later, Pioneer received regulatory approval for an anti-rootworm corn variety that had that same toxin in it. But it turns out the data that they submitted to EPA showed had no signs of a potential harm to these lady beetles. In this study that was submitted to the EPA, the company fed purified toxin to the lady beetles only through the seventh day of the life cycle. The laboratory that did that work said that they found 100% died after the eighth day. So the company presented data just through the seventh day, one day short of when they would be in their susceptible stage. In a second study, the company followed the ladybird beetles through the end of their life cycle, but used a different mode of feeding. As it turns out, the anonymous researcher maintains that the Pioneer studies were flawed. The EPA was made aware of those independently produced data. They opted not to act, and Pioneer also would not give scientists the permission to redo the study on the new crop that was commercialized. Because what they said is, well, we used a slightly different variety. It's the same toxin, just inserted in a different
study. So where we stand then is the government won't say the companies that manufacture the GMOs won't study them or won't allow for the independent study of them. But what happens when people actually study them? Because there are people studying them. A couple of them come to mind, Dr. Don Huber, professor emeritus, Purdue University, Caen University in France. And when independents study them, then big trouble happens, and that's what we're going to talk about when we come back with Dr. Michael Hansen, who is a senior staff scientist for Consumers Union. We're asking, who says genetically modified foods are safe? And hey, do you believe them when they tell you that? This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned. It's just food, right, folks? That's all it is. Right back. Well, folks, are genetically modified foods safe to eat? Our government does not say, and it will not test. So we don't, if we look to our government for guidance, all our government will say essentially is nothing. What about independent studies from our land-grant universities and all of the intelligent people in our universities? Well, they must ask permission from the people who manufacture these GMOs, and they will only probably grant permission if they decide that the research is heading in the direction they want that research to head in. And thus, the opportunity for doing independent research on genetically modified foods is really hard to come by. But what about those outlaws, the researchers out there in the world who are actually looking at the safety of genetically modified foods? And I'm thinking right now of the report recently that came out of Caen University in France, where they fed some rats some BT corn and some other rats some regular corn. And what was the result, Dr. Michael Hansen?
That was not a BT corn variety. It was NK603, NK604, and that's a Roundup Ready.
Oh, okay, so we're talking variety. About Roundup Ready
yeah.
corn. Okay.
Well, what they found is the thing that generated the most media attention was the dramatic increase in tumors, that mammary tumors that were found, and they tended to appear earlier in the animals that had been fed the engineered diets, and more of them died. That study has
everybody has attacked the study. I mean, if you Google that Caen study, it seems like the entire scientific establishment is giving it a bad time for using the wrong kind of rats or not doing this or not doing that.
There have been some scientists that actually have come out in support of his right to do that study. I've actually helped draft a letter that's posted on Independent Science Reviews. But in defense of Dr. Cerellini, it should be pointed out that the strain of rat that they use, the reason they use that one, is because in the same journal 8 years before, a Monsanto study, which showed that the NK603 fed to rats was safe, those are the kinds of rats they used. As for the sample size, they said was too small. There were only 10 animals per group. Well, if you go back and you look at the original study that was used, on NK603. When they tested the parameters in the blood and all these things, they only tested 10 rats per group. So it's the same number of rats. And it should also be pointed out, when glyphosate was actually reapproved in Europe, in Germany, the two-year safety study on glyphosate used the same strain of rats. That's why Cirillini did that, because if you have a short-term feeding study, which was only 90 days, that's what was done in 2004 that was published in the same journal. All Cirillini did is said, okay, we're going to use the same rats because only I'm going to do a two-year study and not just one for 90 days. Because you want to use the same strain of rat, because if you would have used a different strain of rat for the longer-term study, then you could have people arguing of, well, maybe they showed this problem in the long-term study because it's a different strain of rat. So they used the same strain of rat, and they used the same sample size that was used for the study that supposedly showed it was safe. Now, I do admit that the data for when you're trying to look at cancer or carcinogenicity, you should have a much larger number of animals, and his results, some of them weren't statistically significant. But for the people that complain about those two main issues, how come it's insufficient for a study to show that there's a safety problem, but when the same kind of sample sizes are used and the same number of animals are used for a much smaller study, which doesn't find a problem, then Europe allows that to say that proves that this product is safe? That is a double standard. And
you know, I turned to Dr. Don Huber, who is a retired professor of plant pathology from Purdue University, professor emeritus, highly respected, until he came out with a study that also showed some...
But he actually, part of the problem with Dr. Huber's study is there has been, to date, nothing published in the scientific literature where there can be independent review. Maybe he has found something, but this supposed new organism and other stuff, there's no papers out so far.
Right, so nothing really.
It's been over 18 months since his letter went in to the agency, and there's still not a single study that has come out. You have to have data out there that can then be disputed one way or another.
Like the Kane study did.
Exactly.
I mean, the Kane study had data that you can talk about then.
Exactly.
But when somebody does an independent study like this, that's also attacked as being... it seems if you Google the Kane study, there's like 1,000 people attacking it. It's just an organized... independent studies.
Yes, there's actually, this happens frequently. There's a whole coterie of scientists that whenever there's an adverse environmental impact or a feeding study, there's this a wave of attacks happen and vituperation, not just from industry, but from these academic scientists. There's Emily Walls has actually written at least three articles in Nature and Nature Biotechnology that has talked about all these researchers and the way that they've been attacked when they have found adverse effects. There's Angelica Hilbeck, who's done fantastic work showing this.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break, Dr. Hansen, but when we come back, I have to ask you the really big question was, who should we as consumers listen to with respect to the safety of genetically modified foods? Who, if not the governor, if not universities, who can we listen to? Right back. Well, folks, if you're a farmer, you just gotta love the Smart Stacks corn. By golly, it can kill six kinds of insect pests and withstand two kinds of herbicides. Boy, it's the kind, right? But what if you're a consumer and thinking about eating this corn, and you kind of scratch your head and go, well, who do I listen to? Who will guarantee the safety of this stuff? Well, the federal government will not test it for safety and will not say. The universities cannot do independent tests without getting permission from the people who manufacture them. There are some independents out there that are doing tests, but by and large, they're being shouted down. So who's left, Dr. Michael Hansen? Who do we talk to?
Unfortunately, since there's very little independent testing, there is some. There's been work that has been done by scientists over in Europe, in Italy, and elsewhere that have raised questions. That's why people are fighting for labeling, because they don't know. We're all functionally guinea pigs. And I would just like to finally point out another big thing that happened this year in June is the American Medical Association, while it does not support labeling, it changed its policy on genetically engineered foods. And what they did is they changed their policy, so now they have come out in support of mandatory pre-market safety testing before these crops are allowed on the market.
Oh, that's really
and
bad.
Yeah, that does not happen here. And I should point out, globally, there's an agreement that all these crops should be tested for safety before they're allowed on the market, and the U.S. can't meet that criteria. So people are in the dark here, and that's why a lot of folks want labeling, is so they can make their own decisions about whether they want to be guinea pigs or not by eating these foods.
Well, let's go quickly to the phones, 831-479-1080. Sandy, what do you think?
Well, I believe that aspartame is a GMO product, if I'm not mistaken, and they have to label for that because of the potential for severe allergic reactions with certain people, and it just seems to me that if you're introducing all kinds of exotic proteins into plants that people common food products people eat, there have to be people out there that are having severe allergic reactions or allergic reactions to these products, and how can they know what's causing their allergic reactions if they don't know that they're eating an exotic protein.
Great point. Dr. Hansen, thank you, Sandy.
That's a good point, although I would point out aspartame, which is also known as NutraSweet, I don't believe is engineered. The reason it has to be on labels of products is because it's an added ingredient. And some of us have argued that, yes, engineering, you could say that that these engineered constructs that are put in foods could also meet the definition of ingredient and therefore should be on a label as well.
Jan, really quickly.
Hi, I just want to know if we're going to be considered genetically modified people if we eat this food.
Good point. Who knows? Well, Dr. Hansen, what do we do? I mean, if we really want to know, is there any way to know? There really isn't, is there?
Well, what you can do is organic food can't knowingly use genetically engineered materials in its production. There's also a third party system that this
verifies
non-GMO.
And maybe we can vote. We're running out of time, but there is a proposition on the line. Dr. Hansen, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you all out there for tuning in. Remember to go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and really live. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.